welcome you to this public lecture at the LSE, a very full house. I'm not in the least surprised because, of course, William Julius Wilson is one of the most distinguished, in fact, arguably the most distinguished sociologist working in the field today. He's, I think, chiefly renowned for his ability to take on the conventional wisdom and to leave it in tatters. He took on the civil rights establishment when he wrote his book about the declining significance of race, emphasizing the importance of class as an instrument of social stratification. He took on the crude simplicities of the new right when he took on Charles Murray and others when in his famous book, The Truly Disadvantaged. And now he's working on a book called When Work Disappears, The World of the New Urban Poor. And he's also advising President Clinton, I gather, on race, the inner city, and work. I'm not sure that's quite taking on the conventional wisdom, but there's no doubt he will be able to enlighten us about some of his work in that area. His list of honours is several pages. I will not be able to summarise them all. He is currently the Lucy Flower University Professor of Sociology and Public Policy and the Director of the Center for the Study of Urban Inequality at the University of Chicago. But he's moving over to Harvard University, to the Kennedy School, in September. He has been honored by a roll call of the most distinguished universities in the United States, the University of Pennsylvania, Princeton, Columbia, Haverford, the University of New York at Binghamton, and so on. A list too long to go on to. He's going to tell us today about some of his latest thoughts in the general area of whether American ghetto trends are emerging in Europe. And with that, over to Professor Wilson.
Thank you very much. Just one minor correction. The book is in press. I'm not working on it anymore, thank God. It will be published by Knopf in early September. It's called When Work Disappears, The World of the New Urban Poor. Thank you very much for having me here. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to share with you my thoughts concerning a question that will grow in importance in the years to come. First world social inequality. Is there a growing convergence? However, I would emphasize that the question of whether American ghetto trends are emerging in Europe is one that cannot be ignored in this connection. The issues are complex. The question is important. It cannot be ignored, and it certainly could not be more timely. Since the late 1970s, a new form of social inequality has emerged on both sides of the Atlantic, described as a new poverty. It reflects changes in the size and composition of economically marginal groups. In the United States, poverty has become more urban, more concentrated, and more firmly implanted in inner city neighborhoods and large metropolises, particularly in older cities with immense and highly segregated black and Hispanic residents. In Europe, links between race or minority status and social exclusion and deprivation have become increasingly evident over the past decade and have been compounded by the upsurge of xenophobia and racial animosity since the late 1980s. Now, what most characterizes a new poverty is that it affects the life chances of the poor more acutely than in the recent past. It has involved qualitative changes in the status, social relations, and expectations of the poor, and does not just represent new forms of material inequality and deprivation. These problems derive in part from the declining labor market opportunities for those of limited education. Indeed, much of the sharp rise in inner city joblessness in the United States and the growth of unemployment in Europe and Canada stems from the swift technological changes in the global economy. First of all, there has been a decline in mass production. The effects of this change are perhaps most clearly seen in the U.S. economy, which has traditionally enjoyed rapid growth in productivity and living standards. The mass production system benefited from large quantities of cheap natural resources, economies of scale, and processes that generated higher uses of productivity through shifts in market forces that caused improvements in one industry to lead to advancement in others. The skill requirements of the mass production system were reflected in the system of learning. Public schools in the United States were principally designed to provide low-income native and immigrant students with the basic literacy and numeracy skills required for routine work in the mass production factories, service industries, or farms. On the other hand, families with professional, technical, and managerial backgrounds had access to elite learning processes in public and private schools and were able to utilize family connections and experiences to prepare their children for higher paying occupations. The school-to-work transition processes were informal and largely family-related, but were perpetuated through the formal learning system. Today's close interaction between technology and international competition has eroded the basic institutions of the mass production system. In the last several decades, almost all of the improvements in productivity have been associated with technology and human capital, thereby drastically reducing the importance of physical capital and natural resources. Moreover, in the traditional mass production system, only a few highly educated professional, technical, and managerial workers were needed because most of the work was routine and could be performed by workers who needed only basic literacy and numeracy. Accordingly, workers with limited education were able to take home wages that were comparatively high by international and historical standards. Today, however, at the same time that changes in technology are producing new jobs, they are making others obsolete. The workplace has been revolutionized by technological changes that range from the development of robotics to the creation of information highways. A widening gap between the skilled and unskilled workers is developing because education and training are more important than ever. Indeed, because of low levels of education, more and more unskilled workers are out of work or poorly paid in both the United States and Europe. While educated workers are benefiting from the pace of technological change, less skilled workers, such as those found in many inner city neighborhoods, face the growing threat of job displacement. For example, highly skilled designers, engineers, and operators are needed for the jobs created by the development of a new set of computer-oriented machine tools, an advance that also eliminates jobs for those trained only for manual assembly line work. Also, advances in word processing have increased the demand for those who not only know how to type, but can operate specialized software as well. The need for routine typists and secretaries is accordingly reduced. The impact of technological change has been enhanced by international competition. In order to adjust to changing market and technology, competitive systems have been forced to become more flexible. Companies can compete more effectively in the international market by either improving productivity and quality or by reducing workers' income. The easier approach is a low-wage strategy which the United States has tended to follow. According to Ray Marshall, the former Secretary of Labor in the Carter administration, quote, most other industrialized nations have rejected this strategy because it implies lower and more unequal wages with serious political, social, and economic implications, unquote. To encourage Western European and Japanese companies to follow high wage strategies, several actions have been taken. First, governments work to create national consensus for recovery strategies, perhaps the most important step toward effective changes. Companies were then poised to pursue high wage strategies in a political and regulatory environment that included adjustment processes to shift resources from low to high productivity activities, trade and industrial policies, wage regulations, relatively generous family support systems, unemployment compensation, and universal national health care. But with a sharp rise in unemployment, there is growing pressure on European nations to adopt the low-wage strategy pursued by the United States. Allow me to elaborate. A few years ago, when unemployment rose in all the major industrial democracies during the worldwide recession, the conventional wisdom was that the upturn in the business cycle would solve most of the problem. When the United States entered a period of economic recovery in the early 1990s and the worst of the recession was over in Europe, there was still a scarcity of new high-wage jobs on both sides of the Atlantic, a situation that created fears that that the duration of the shortage would be lengthy. In the highly integrated global marketplace of today, economies can grow, stock markets can rise, corporate profits can soar, and yet many workers can be unemployed or underemployed. Why? Because capital and technology are now so mobile that they do not always create good jobs in their own backyard. Corporate cutbacks and efforts to streamline for the global economy have added to the jobless woes of many workers. In short, economic growth today does not necessarily produce good jobs. In comparison between the United States and other industrialized nations, the problem of jobs is seen in different dimensions. Europe and Canada have continued to increase wages and benefits for their workers, but at a price of high levels of unemployment for many others who are kept afloat with generous unemployment insurance. In 1994, 11% of the European workforce, or 18 million people, were unemployed. By contrast, the United States, which moved out of the recession earlier, has created more jobs, mainly by getting workers to accept low-paying employment. The result has been a widening gap in the United States between the highest and lowest paid workers. Because of Europe's social safety nets, many eschew the kind of low-paying jobs taken by low-skilled workers in the United States. They rely instead on relatively generous unemployment compensation. In most of the European Union, an unemployed worker can receive close to $1,000 a month, some cases indefinitely. In addition, Europe's highly regulated job markets, where it's very difficult to dismiss workers, have left employers wary of creating jobs. This has led not only to a steady growth in unemployment and increases in wages and social security contributions, but a less and less competitive European industry as well. The U.S. economy created 35 million jobs between 1973 and 1991. Europe added just 8 million during the same period, despite having about one-third more people. And understand that overwhelming majority of these jobs were in the public sector. Moreover, in a more flexible labor market in the United States, real wages grew each year by less than 0.5%, less than 0.5%. Whereas annual real wage growth in Europe rose three times as fast. Minimum wage levels tend to be higher in Europe, with cost of living increases and a four-week annual and 4-week annual vacations virtually guaranteed. Total compensation, wages, health benefits, vacations for the typical U.S. worker in manufacturing has either remained flat or declined since the mid-1970s, while it has increased by 40% for a European worker in a comparable job. Average compensation for a manufacturing worker in the United States is $16 an hour. In Germany, it's $26. Disadvantaged groups in America suffer the most. During the 1980s, the wages for low-income U.S. workers who lacked any college education dropped 15% when adjusted for inflation, whereas those for comparable workers in Europe increased 15 to 20%. There is mounting pressure on European countries to make some adjustments in order to become globally competitive again. Some European observers have argued that there will have to be a massive reduction in the continent's labor force. Others emphasize that production will have to be transferred to lower wage parts of the world. Both strategies will lead to even greater unemployment. Still, other strategists claim that one way to combat the growing problems of unemployment, including those from industrial cost-cutting of the kind endured by American industries, is to develop the service sector, even if the jobs do carry lower wages. In so doing, restrictions on zoning laws and store opening hours would have to be relaxed. Also, the welfare state would have to be altered by lowering taxes and non-wage contributions that significantly increase total labor costs. This strategy would create more low-wage jobs, but it would also, as in the United States, lead to greater inequality among workers. A recent report based on interviews with leading government officials, corporate executives, economists, and union leaders in Europe reveals pessimism about any action that might be taken to address the problem of global competition. These leaders feel that Europe lacks both the time and the political will to change social and political habits enough to allow the private sector to compete globally and thus generate the number of new jobs needed to contain the unemployment. In other words, as one observer put it, and I quote, "Most everyone agrees on the desirability of slashing regulatory red tape, taxes, and the non-wage labor costs that supports Europe's encrusted social protection programs. But few believe it will happen anytime soon," unquote. How Europe deals with the matter of job creation, with the matter of global competition, will certainly have implications for the problem of urban inequality. Historically, the nature of urban inequality in Europe and the United States has contrasted sharply. No European city has experienced a level of concentrated poverty and racial and ethnic segregation that is typical of American metropolises. Nor does any European city include areas that are as physically isolated, deteriorated, and prone to violence as the inner city ghettos of urban America. In short, there is no real European equivalent to the plight of the American ghetto. Nonetheless, the situation is changing, and it's changing rapidly. European cities are beginning to experience many of the problems of urban social dislocations, including increasing unemployment, concentrated poverty, and racial and ethnic conflicts that have traditionally plagued American cities. European cities differ in the origins of their racial and ethnic problems. The rising ethnic conflicts in Eastern Europe, which have accompanied the breakdown of the Soviet Empire, stem from nationalist political struggles in a period of democratization, not from immigration. However, there are significant differences among the countries of Western Europe. Since the late 1960s, Northern European countries have received workers from Turkey, the countries of Northwest Africa, North Africa, the Middle East, the former British, Dutch, and French territories. These immigrant flows have widened the cultural experiences of European nations, and differences between immigrants and, and, and indigenous populations are disturbing the traditionally homogeneous makeup of communities. Now, when discussing urban poverty and racial tensions, the European countries that have been most frequently contrasted with the United States are Britain, France, Holland, and Belgium. Britain, France, Holland, and Belgium. All of these countries were colonial powers, and racial groups from those former colonies have been prominently represented among recent immigrants. A number of other countries, including Switzerland, Norway, Sweden, and Germany, have experienced an influx of immigrants who have come mainly as laborers from Southern Europe and as refugees from countries outside Europe. Finally, the southern part of Europe, which for most of the mid-20th century represent what we call sending countries, that is, countries whose own citizens often became immigrant workers, are now experiencing a fairly rapid growth of immigration from the countries of Northwest Africa. The immigrants, including first and second generation immigrants in all of these countries, are disproportionately represented in areas that feature the highest levels of unemployment. Although they are far from matching the depth and severity of the social dislocations that plague the inner city ghettos in the United States, many inner city communities and outer city public housing estates in countries like France and the Netherlands have been cut off from mainstream labor markets and informal job networks, creating the vicious cycle of weak labor force attachment, growing social exclusion, and racial tensions. Although these European inner-city communities still feature many indigenous residents and are therefore more mixed than the nearly black-only ghettos of the United States, their population is invariably drawn disproportionately from the various first and second-generation immigrant minorities. Trends in a number of European countries suggest the beginnings of a social polarization in cities that resembles the characteristics of American metropolises. More important, however, the economic and industrial restructuring of Europe, which includes the decline of traditional manufacturing areas, has decreased the need for unskilled immigrant labor. Thousands of the immigrants who had been recruited during periods of national labor shortages have now been laid off. A substantial number of the new jobs in the next several decades will require levels of training and education that are beyond the reach of most immigrant minorities. Being the last hired and the first fired, unemployment rates among first and second generation immigrant minorities, soared during the 1970s through the 1980s. This is not unlike the situation experienced by those in the inner city ghettos of the United States. Now, given the sharp rise in persistent unemployment among European workers, and the fact that much of it is concentrated among minority immigrant populations, it should not be surprising that in several quarters and with increasing frequency, European observers warn that if present trends continue, cities in Europe may soon feature ghettos that resemble those in the United States. When such comparisons are made, however, differences in the social and political organization of American and European cities are rarely taken into account. In American cities, groups can be more easily separated by income, race, and ethnicity because of differences in land use policy, housing policy, the organization of social policy, and federal urban policy. Municipalities in the United States have much greater autonomy than do those in Europe. Municipalities in the United States have much greater control over population movement and urban developments through zoning and other measures ostensibly designed to ensure a community's health. Local U.S. authorities have the power to determine what kinds of people can live and what kinds of business activities can be conducted within their borders. A major factor in the creation of separate political jurisdictions has been the organization of a social policy that reflects the greater autonomy of localities in the United States. This is particularly true with respect to education. Given the middle class's long-established norm of enrolling their children in public schools in the United States, a strong impetus for groups to separate themselves by income or by race has been the traditional use of local property taxes to finance education. When education is funded locally, citizens tend to think of the cost of education being directed toward their own offspring, or at least children within their own class or ethnic group, and are willing to contribute accordingly. The amount of money spent per child typically increases as one moves from the central city to the inner suburbs to the outlying affluent communities in the United States. Also, federal government policies have contributed to the growth of local fragmentation. On the one hand, the building of numerous federally financed freeways and the creation of mortgage programs to subsidize private home ownership in order to meet the post-war housing demands contributed substantially to the growth of suburban communities, including many new political jurisdictions. On the other hand, the federal government's bound to local opposition to subsidize housing that might promote integration, or I should say the federal government bowed to local opposition to subsidize housing that might promote integration. Indeed, opposition from organized community groups to the building of public housing in their neighborhoods and de facto federal policy to tolerate extensive segregation against blacks in urban housing markets have led to massive segregated housing projects that have become ghettos for the minorities and disadvantaged. Accordingly, since local acceptance dictated federal housing policies, public housing was overwhelmingly concentrated in the overcrowded and deteriorating inner city ghettos, the poorest and least socially organized sections in any metropolitan area. In America, public housing represents a federally funded, physically permanent institution for the isolation of families by race and class, and has therefore contributed to the isolation of many minority residents in inner city ghettos in recent years. Finally, since 1980, a fundamental shift in the federal government's support for basic urban programs has aggravated the problems of joblessness and social organization in ghetto neighborhoods. The Reagan and Bush administrations, proponents of the new federalism, sharply cut spending on direct aid to cities, including general revenue sharing, urban mass transit, public service jobs and job training, compensatory education, social service block grants, local public works, economic development assistance, and urban development action grants. In 1980, the federal contribution to city budgets was 18%. By 1990, it had plummeted to 6.4%. In addition, the economic recession, which began in the Northeast in 1989 and lasted until the early 1990s, sharply reduced revenues that the cities themselves generated, thereby creating budget deficits that resulted in further cutbacks in basic services and programs and increases in local taxes. The combination of the new federalism and the recession created for many cities in the United States, especially the older cities of the East and Midwest, the worst fiscal and service crisis since the Depression. Cities have become increasingly underserviced, and many have been on the brink of bankruptcy. In facing these crises, they have therefore not been in a position to combat effectively three unhealthy social conditions that have emerged or become prominent since 1980. The first is the prevalence of crack cocaine addiction and its attendant violent crimes. Secondly, the AIDS epidemic and its escalating public health costs. And thirdly, the sharp rise in a homeless population, not only for individuals, but for whole families as well. Although drug addiction and its attendant violence, AIDS and its terrible toll on public health resources, and homelessness are found in many American communities, their impact on the ghetto is profound. These communities, whose residents have been pushed to the margins of society, have few resources to combat these plagues that arose in the 1980s. Fiscally strapped cities have watched helplessly as these problems, exacerbated by the rise of ghetto joblessness, the decline of social organization in the inner cities, and the reduction of social services, have made the city at large seem a dangerous and threatening place to live. Accordingly, working and middle-class urban residents continue to relocate in the suburbs. In 1960, the U.S. population was evenly divided between cities, suburbs, and rural areas, evenly divided. By 1990, both urban and rural populations had declined, so that suburbs contained nearly half of the nation's population. Urban residents dipped to 31% of the U.S. population by 1990. As cities lost population, they became poorer and darker in their racial and ethnic composition. Thus, in the eyes of many in the dominant white population, the minorities symbolized the ugly urban scene left behind. Today, the divide between the suburbs and the city is, in many respects, a racial divide. For example, whereas minorities constituted 63% of all the residents in the city of Chicago in 1990, 83% of all suburban residents in the Chicago metropolitan area were white. Across the nation in 1990, 74% of the dominant white population lived in suburban and rural areas, while a majority of blacks and Latinos resided in urban areas. Now, the growing suburbanization of the population influences the extent to which national politicians will support increased federal aid to large cities and to the poor. Indeed, we can associate the sharp drop in federal support for basic urban programs since 1980 with the declining political influence of cities and the rising influence of electoral coalitions in the suburbs. Suburbs cast 36% of the vote for president in 1968, 48% in 1988, and a majority of the vote in the 1992 election. In each of the three presidential races before the 1992 election, the Democratic presidential candidate captured huge majorities in large cities, but the electoral votes went to the Republican opponent, who gained an even larger number of votes from the suburban and rural residents of the states where these cities are located. And this naked reality is one of the reasons why the successful Clinton presidential campaign pursued a careful strategy designed to capture the support of voters who do not reside in central cities, voters who represent an emerging and increasingly powerful solidarity group. Clinton is not a fool. That's why he got elected. But my liberal colleagues, they continue to criticize him because he doesn't push out that urban policy. If he's reelected, you can bet your bottom, well, whatever, that that there will be an urban policy because he won't have to worry about reelection. Remember, I said this. These aspects of the American political system, land use policy, housing policy, the organization of social policy, and federal urban policy contribute to greater racial differences and make the problems of racially identified, concentrated poverty more extreme and intractable. Consider by comparison Britain and France, two countries that have also had, that also have a significant number of citizens who are racial minorities and who tend to be concentrated in deteriorated areas. In Britain, the strong central government has exerted a good deal of control over population movements and urban developments. Local authorities have far less autonomy than in the United States in the highly centralized British political system. Until recently, the only local source of revenue to which they had access was a tax levied on businesses and property owners. Thus, unlike in the United States, the quality of local public schools is far less determined by the resources of local government governments, and therefore the association between schooling and residence is not as strong. Because of lack of autonomy and of discretion in financing, competition between local jurisdictions is far less apparent than in the United States. Furthermore, unlike in the United States, where the federal government subsidized suburban home ownership to satisfy post-war housing demands, the rebuilding of housing stock in Britain occurred mainly through the construction of public housing. By the end of the 1970s, a third of British households lived in council housing. The very size of the British sector made some levels of income mixing inevitable. Moreover, council housing in Britain was less often concentrated in certain locations. The government's aim to decentralize the urban population resulted in the construction of council housing both within and outside the central city. By the late 1980s, although 43% of the council estates were located in poor inner London, 29% were located in central London and 23% in outer London. Although the post-war population sorting in Britain did affect racial mixing, the sharp racial concentration so characteristic of cities in the United States did not occur because public housing was not deliberately segregated. With the absence of pre-existing ghettos, racial considerations were not a major factor in decisions on the building and location of public housing. Many public housing units were built in working-class neighborhoods that had not yet experienced the influx of minority immigrants and were not defined racially. Moreover, opportunities for the working class to move to suburban owner-occupied housing were restricted because of limiting financing and less favorable tax treatment of mortgages. A somewhat different pattern prevails in France, where cities tend to be more desirable as places to reside and suburbs contain concentrations of disadvantaged populations. Overseen by the Central Planning Agency, the public housing program, traditionally populated mainly by the middle and lower middle classes, has recently opened up to immigrant minorities whose presence has gradually increased since 1970. 14% of the French population now resides in public housing. In some estates, as much as 30% of the public housing population is made up of immigrants. Although poor ethnic and racial minorities are often concentrated in suburban high-rise public housing where they endure the hardships of physical isolation, central housing and land use policies have limited population movements and have permitted more mixing of people by income, ethnicity, and race than is the case in either Britain or the United States. However, recent population movements and government action in Britain and France have increased concentrated poverty and racial ethnic segregation that have increased. Recent population movements and government action in Britain and France that have increased concentrated poverty and racial ethnic segregation suggest a growing convergence with the United States. Just as the promotion of home ownership by the U.S. government in the 1950s sharply increased the suburbanization of the middle classes, so too has the recent government's promotion of home ownership more than a decade later in both France and Britain contributed to the suburbanization of the middle classes there. Moreover, as the barriers to their entry into these countries have been removed, the concentration of the minority poor in public housing has grown. These two developments have separated populations along racial and ethnic lines in a manner that resembles historic racial sorting in the United States. And the problems associated with the concentration of high-rise public housing have contributed to the growing segregation of the British and French populations. Difficult to maintain, many of the housing blocks quickly became dilapidated, undesirable places to live, propelling those who were able to find housing elsewhere. Also in Rotterdam in the Netherlands, although inner-city neighborhoods are more mixed in terms of ethnicity and social class due to extensive urban renewal, there are a number of interconnected streets or block clusters where nearly everyone is unemployed or on public assistance, and these blocks resemble many ghetto streets on the south side of Chicago or in Harlem in New York. Nonetheless, I would argue that it is unlikely that these countries, Britain included, will soon experience the degree of income and racial segregation that characterize metropolitan areas in the United States. The central government's control over the formation of new political jurisdictions in these countries reduces the opportunity and incentives for the spatial separation by race and income. Structural arrangements such as local control over education and taxation, and political arrangements that enable localities to incorporate and to resist federal government efforts to site public housing are far fewer in European countries. Accordingly, the quote tipping unquote phenomena, so characteristic of the ghettoization process in American cities, is far less likely to develop. When the tipping mechanism is triggered in a European metropolis, it is much more likely to be restricted to, say, a particular housing project, and can be more easily reversed by government interventions. As Margaret Weir has observed, the political scientist at the Brookings Institution, residents in countries such as Britain and France have not had, quote, the same incentives or opportunities to act on their racial antipathies as in the United States, unquote. Finally, in European countries, suburbanization has not been associated with the abandonment of cities as residential areas. The central governments continue to treat cities as a natural resource to be protected and nurtured. In short, despite signs of growing social inequality, despite signs of a growing convergence, different structural and political arrangements in European countries are likely to reduce the chances that American-style ghettos will emerge in the near future. There are also notable differences between the United States and Europe in the extent to which problems of poverty and inequality are addressed. Despite the increasing strains on the European welfare state and cries to cut back on welfare benefits to combat unemployment. In contrast to many European nations, the United States has not created comprehensive programs to promote the social rights of American citizens. Anti-poverty programs have been narrowly targeted and fragmented. In comparison with Canada and most European countries, social citizenship rights in the United States are less developed and less intertwined with rights of political and civil citizenship. And although social citizenship rights increased in the U.S. after World War II, they have yet to reach the levels enjoyed by the citizens of Europe. For example, American housing policies to promote home ownership have tended to benefit the working and middle classes, not the poor. Direct financial housing subsidies for low-income families, common in European welfare states, has been virtually non-existent in the United States. The housing made available to the poor tends to be confined to a limited number of public projects, disproportionately concentrated in inner-city neighborhoods, far from employment opportunities and informal job information networks. Moreover, Western European societies have always had a much more comprehensive program of unemployment insurance, and the gap has widened each year since the U.S. program lost ground in the early years of the Reagan administration. Indeed, in every year from 1984 through 1988, the proportion of the jobless receiving unemployment insurance benefits in an average month registered a record low. While a number of factors were at work here, including lower rates of application by eligible unemployed workers, federal and state cuts in the program played a role. Finally, in Western European countries, where services such as medical care are considered basic collective goods, the poor tend to be covered by the same comprehensive medical programs as the working and middle classes. In the United States, however, a federal advisory commission recently reported that Medicaid, a health program for poor people, pays doctors much less than either Medicare, which is a program that covers the the health costs of more advantaged people, or private health insurance pay for the same services. As a result, many doctors refuse to take Medicaid patients. Those at the bottom of the class structure in the United States have always suffered greater economic deprivation and insecurity. The most rapid growth in expenditures for U.S. welfare programs has been in universal entitlements, such as Social Security and Medicare, programs whose elderly recipients originate mainly in the working and middle classes. A number of means-tested or targeted programs for the poor have been created in recent years, but the relief they provide is so minimal that they could not prevent the poor in the United States from slipping deeper into poverty. In 1975, for example, 30% of all the poor in the United States had incomes 50% below the officially designated poverty line. In 1992, 40% did so. Among blacks, the increase was even sharper, from 32% in 1975 to nearly half. 49% in 1992. Moreover, the overall poverty rate actually increased after 1978. Now, these disappointing figures are related to such factors as general income stagnation, the erosion of wages for lower-skilled jobs in the private sector, the increase in the proportion of families headed by single women, and the large decrease in real benefit levels provided by states under the Aid for Families with Dependent Children program, the number one public assistance program in the United States. Food stamps, Medicaid, and the Supplemental Social Security Income Program do provide some relief, but as currently designed, they have virtually no effect on the continuing poverty rates among the non-elderly. In short, targeted programs for the poor in the United States do not even begin to address the inequities in the social class system. Instead of helping to integrate the recipients into the broader economic and social life of mainstream society, to, quote, capitalize them, unquote, into a different educational or residential strata, as a GI Bill and several federal mortgage programs did for working and middle class whites following World War II, these programs tend to stigmatize the poor and separate them from the rest of society. However, recent economic crises in Europe have made it difficult to sustain programs that embody universal and integrative social citizenship rights. With the growth of mass unemployment and the growing fragmentation of European labor markets, pressures to cut back on welfare state benefits have mounted. And the increase of racial and ethnic diversity has led some to re-examine the post-war commitment to universal programs and social inclusion, a commitment originally based on conceptions of citizenship that assumed a fair degree of cultural homogeneity. Recent challenges to this social welfare commitment often reflect racial bias. The latest economic and social changes of urban Europe have already created situations ripe for the demagogic mobilization of racism and anti-immigrant feelings. As economic conditions have worsened, many in the majority white population view the growth of minorities as part of the problem. Stagnant economies and slack labor markets have placed strains on the welfare state at the very time when the immigrant population, facing mounting problems of joblessness, have become more dependent on public assistance for survival. When the European economies enjoy tight labor markets and positive economic growth, the welfare state was easily financed. Welfare services with strong popular support were maintained or increased. Cries to cut back on welfare programs, however, accompanied economic stagnation and were influenced by two developments in the 1980s. One was the growing cost of social service programs and entitlements during periods of high unemployment and limited public revenues. The other was a rise to power of conservative governments in the United Kingdom and in the Netherlands, whose views about the need to reduce welfare were buttressed by the political ascendancy of Reaganism in the United States. In various parts of Europe, ethnic and racial antagonisms have been heightened. I was struck by, when I spent a year in Paris in 1989-90, about how many of these flare-ups occurred. Algerians and black Africans have been attacked in several French cities to the dismay of French progressives. Le Pen's anti-immigrant National Front movement has experienced surprising electoral successes. Rioting occurred in several black neighborhoods in Britain. African immigrants have also been attacked in a number of Italian cities, and tensions have surfaced in several Dutch cities between Christians and Muslims and racial minorities and whites. Unfortunately, in view of the growing economic and social dislocations in Europe, both spontaneous and organized expressions of overt racism will likely increase if the economic and social problems I have thus far described are not addressed. In many respects, the post-war Europe that we know today may not resemble the Europe we will see at the turn of the century. As Western Europe enters a period of economic uncertainty and experiences growing problems of poverty concentration, and joblessness among the disadvantaged, individuals concerned about preserving social citizenship rights in democratic states should pay close attention to what has happened in urban America. I say this in part because of the way in which the general public has responded to the increasing visibility of and the deteriorating economic and social situation of minority and immigrant populations here. Although the conditions for expressions of racial antagonisms have increased, as pointed out previously, Europeans, because of differences in political organization, do not have the same opportunities as Americans to act on their racial antipathies. Moreover, official and scholarly explanations of the widening gap between the haves and have-nots in Europe tend to focus much more on the changes and inequities in the broader society, not on individual deficiencies and behavior. Therefore, public rhetoric lends much greater support to the ideology of social citizenship rights. Furthermore, welfare programs that benefit wide segments of the population, such as child care, children's allowances, housing subsidies, education, medical care, and unemployment insurance, have been firmly institutionalized in many Western European democracies. Efforts to cut back on these programs in the face of growing joblessness threaten not just the poor, and thus have met firm resistance from working and middle-class citizens, as we just recently seen in France. Let me end by saying that nonetheless, the problems of high joblessness remain in Europe. They have to be confronted. And they are placing increasing strains on the welfare state and contributing to growing social dislocations, including racial conflicts. Therefore, many of the institutional and social arrangements that have benefited workers in Europe and that distinguish Europe from the United States in the promotion of social citizenship rights could be jeopardized. Can the United States and Europe learn from each other and use that knowledge to develop programs that simultaneously confront the problems of economic growth, wage inequality, and unemployment? This is a serious question. If the answer is yes, a first step in the learning process would be the recognition that the problems of joblessness and economic dislocation and growing economic or income inequality are not unique to any particular country. Indeed, it would be extremely short-sighted to continue to address the growing problems of urban inequality in Europe and the disappearance of work in the inner cities of the U.S. as if they were not part of the larger range of economic and social dislocations that have accompanied rapid changes in the global economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. I think we have a minute or two for one or two questions. The floor is open for a brief question or two. Yes.
Can I just say, despite your very critical comments, you know, they actually resonate with me. They really do. Because I've described the racial tensions in America, but I argue, for example, in my new book, that racism is a product of situations, economic situations, political situations, social situations, demographic situations, you see. And that you give me certain kinds of conditions, I will produce these racial tensions. And I have also argued in this book that, damn it, too much emphasis is placed on the racial division in the public rhetoric and not enough on interracial unity. And I've also called for an affirmative action that's based on class in addition to race, to pick up the people of Mississippi who are denied the opportunity to move there. I could not agree with you more that too much emphasis has been placed on racial divisions in America. But there is a reality there. There are racial tensions. You have to understand the nature of those tensions. And man, please don't associate me with Louis Farrakhan. Farrakhan is a reactionary. And it's amazing that he draws as much support from the militants. You're quite correct. Farrakhan, if you take away the anti-Semitic rhetoric, he sounds like George Bush or Ronald Reagan. The emphasis is not on the structural factors that have produced unfortunate social outcomes. The focus is on individuals. The kind of thing that Charles Murray talks about, individual deficiencies, lack of a work ethic, lack of commitment. That's Farrakhan's message. You see, he uncouples all of that from the structural inequities that you're focusing on. You see, I would suggest, sir, that you read my work, and I think you'd be a little bit more sympathetic.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Could we have another question, please?
Okay.
There we go.
See me afterwards, and see me afterwards, and I'll get a list, and I'll be happy to read it. And then maybe we can talk. Okay, very good.
There will be an opportunity to do that afterwards. So, could we have the next question? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think the point that I was trying to make is that in order to come to grips with the growing problems of joblessness in European nations, and I had in mind especially countries like France, some attention is going to have to be given to the creation of employment in the social service sector. And there is going to have to be some discussion about how you can make the workforce more flexible instead of paying them to stay unemployed indefinitely. Now, in the United States, there has been a sharp increase in social service jobs. These are low-paying jobs. Many of them are part-time jobs, and they have gone disproportionately to women. For all these reasons, low-educated women are working more, not less, than they used to. Unfortunately, this is not reflected in the inner city, because black women are actually working less, because despite the creation of millions of social service jobs, black women have to compete with the influx of white women into the labor market and the large influx of immigrants into the labor market. But they are getting some of these jobs. They're getting many more of these jobs than black men. Black men are virtually excluded from the social service sector. In fact, men in general, are not getting jobs in this sector. Low-educated men are working less than they used to, you see. So despite the sharp increase in the number of jobs, there are certain segments of the U.S. population, low-educated men of all ethnic groups, and those in the inner city who have not really benefited from this, you see. And so I know it sounds interesting that you can create 35 million jobs over several decades and still have the kinds of jobless problems that we have in inner city, but these jobs have only benefited certain segments of the population.
Thank you. Yes, I'll take two more. Yes.
Well, if you had asked me that question, if you had rephrased that question and said if you were appointed social policy advisor to Clinton, I am an informal advisor to Clinton, but mostly sort of talk to him about how we can improve racial matters in the United States. Although we have talked about the problems of joblessness and what you have to do to create jobs. Then I would not hesitate to say what has to be done. But I'm gonna throw something out for your consideration. I'm still learning about the situation in Britain. Look, there is a severe problem of joblessness in this country for certain segments of the population, particularly those who are concentrated in the council estates. And I don't think you can rely on the private sector to generate jobs. I know that the infrastructure in British cities is better than the infrastructure in America, but there are things that can be done with the creation of public sector jobs to put people back to work. So that's one thing that I would recommend. Creation of public sector employment to focus on rebuilding or preserving the infrastructure. That would be a quick, easy solution. It would be expensive. But when people talk about things being expensive, it's often because they're low on a priority list. When things are low on the priority list, they're dismissed as being too expensive. So you've got to generate some sort of coalition politics that would put things higher on the priority list, and you've got to be able to talk about programs that are designed to reach broad segments of the population so the public work jobs are available to anyone who needs a job. And therefore, folks who are facing growing economic insecurity know that they have this to fall back on, and you might be able to rally the troops, particularly those in the have-not ranks, because the ranks of the have-nots are growing, and they're not restricted to any particular minority or any particular racial group. They're affecting the various racial minorities. They're affecting whites. Golden opportunity here to be under proper leadership to rally the troops behind such a program.
Could I abuse my chairman's position for a moment and follow that up for a second? One of the implications of what you were saying was that, as I understood it, was one of the differences between Britain and the US was the relative powerlessness of local government in the UK as compared with the US. And indeed, that was actually a positive factor contributing to some of the trends not emerging in the UK. There are many people in Britain who would argue that the centralisation of British government is on the whole a bad thing, and that we ought to shift power much more firmly back to local government. But is an implication of what you're saying is that that would be really quite a dangerous strategy, at least from this perspective?
I somehow am thinking about the overwhelming emphasis on decentralization in the United States. I look with great envy people of European countries with a strong central government because you're able to get things done. I am for government, let's face it. I'm for the government playing a greater role in alleviating racial and ethnic and class inequality. And a strong central government is in a much better position to do that than the kind of decentralized states' rights position that we are now currently emphasizing in the United States.
I stole the last question, so there's one more. Over there?
No.
Oh, all right. Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll take one question from upstairs. Gentleman right at the back.
I've got a question which is really, your emphasis is on the urban poor. And I think that I'm just wondering whether this is really the, in this climate, whether this is really the right emphasis for any kind of urban resistance movement that you want. The reason why I say this is that you mentioned that Europe should look at America and take note of the trends that go on there. And I think that in one area,
the area of what?
Law and order.
All right, law and order.
Mm-hmm. New York's zero tolerance or low tolerance seems to be fairly popular, both with both sides of the cabinet here. And I think that it really is indicative of the way that much discussion of the city today, the urban reality, is kind of presenting a worst case scenario. This very much concentrates on the urban poor and the situation there. If you look at the crime figures, one example where the kind of fear of crime and people's perceptions and realities of crime are very, very different. And it's precisely that fear that is fairly debilitating today. And the kind of the constant presentation of the situation as a worst case scenario is going to really overlook how we overcome that kind of problem of the fact that people are problem solvers and not actually risk avoiders.
Well, that's a very good question, a very, very thoughtful question. Let me just say this. Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein published a book in 1994 entitled The Bell Curve, in which they argued that too much emphasis has been placed on the environment to explain the social outcomes of groups, including disadvantaged groups in inner city neighborhoods. And so now we have a genetic endowment argument used by prominent people to explain social outcomes. At this particular time, social scientists like myself, who have the big picture in mind, and whose research does not uncouple social policy from research, have a moral obligation to talk about the devastating effects of the environment on the most vulnerable populations, to set the record straight, to to reverse the kinds of reactionary public policies that are now being pursued in the United States, and you can't do that without addressing the particular plight of this group, you see. But when you begin to talk about social policy options, it's important to show the connection of this group to the broader society, to indicate, for example, that this group is also influenced by some of the broader changes that I'm talking about. Even though they may be more extreme than the economic dislocations experienced by other groups in society, nonetheless, they represent the same general trends. And therefore, when we talk about solutions to their problems, we want to emphasize programs that are designed to capture or rescue all groups that are experiencing economic insecurity. When I talk about expanding the ranks of the have-nots in a political coalition, I'm talking about getting people to recognize that although the problems in the inner city are severe, they represent a more extreme form of the economic dislocations that are affecting broad segments of the population. And therefore, we should all be working together, pursuing, for example, race-neutral strategies. This is one of the things I've been emphasizing, pursuing race-neutral strategies to address the plight of disadvantaged groups and groups that are on the verge of becoming a disadvantage.
Just before we close, I have been asked by Ann Power to thank Gary and Janet Wolfe and LSE Housing for the work they put in for organizing this event. And also, I think we must thank Ann Power herself, who has done an enormous amount of work to set this up. But most of all, we must thank Professor Wilson. When we were walking here to come to the lecture, we were talking about the inability of economists to listen to anybody other than economists. And he was describing to me that a Nobel Prize-winning economist, Robert Lucas, was walking past him in the corridor the other day, and I hope I get the story right, when he stopped and said, hey, Bill, I've just been reading your book, and with a note of surprise in his voice, I learned something. Well, I'm an economist, although not quite the same kind, or indeed stature, of Robert Lucas, but I've learned something. I've learned a lot, and I suspect that everybody in the audience has too. We're very grateful to you. Thank you.